My name is Mel Peel, and this is the session on Roman Catholicism in America. This week I'm going to be talking about the Catholic Church and particularly the Catholic worker movement, but I thought it would be very useful to begin this series by talking a little more broadly about Roman Catholicism in the United States for a couple of reasons. First of all, in some ways, the Catholic worker movement, in which I'm particularly interested, and I hope to arouse some interest around here as well, is a very important social movement, I think, in the American Catholic Church, but it's hardly typical at all. So that, in some ways, I think it's useful to try to set a sort of context for talking about the Catholic worker in order to see where it sits in relation to this vast thing called the American Catholic Church. Perhaps I might say, for those of you who are not Catholic, it's as if someone came to Holden Village for a few weeks, as Walter Altman has, and would go away and say, well, now I understand American Lutheranism. I've got a good view of it here. I've been at Holden Village. And I might suggest that perhaps he'd gotten a particular kind of slice and segment and not quite seen the entire affair. So we're going to start off talking about Catholicism in America, Roman Catholicism in America, and then talk about this very particular social movement. I also think it's useful in this ecumenical age, particularly, for all of us to begin to think about other Christian traditions and attempt to understand other Christian traditions in various kinds of ways. Obviously, these sort of contacts go on in different sorts of settings. They go on at the very formal theological level, where you have highly trained theological experts engaging in various sorts of exchanges. The Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogues that some of you might know about have been going on for, I think, nearly two decades now, and they put out these very elaborate and interesting but difficult volumes. For example, here's the one on papal primacy in the universal church, and you can read here Lutheran and Catholic theologians exchanging opinions on these matters. We also have lots of informal ecumenical exchanges these days, right? I mean, people meet Catholics all over the place. There are interfaith marriages, and we talk about matters of religion in sort of casual and informal ways, and those are very valuable too. But I think it's useful to sort of step back a bit as well and think about the relationships between different Christian traditions at a level that's not that of the formal theological experts, but not also just the casual kind of encounters which we have with representatives of various traditions in our ordinary lives, important as those are. So I guess this is partly a little bit of a introduction to the week, but also I hope it helps, especially for those who are Lutheran, but also some Catholics or others perhaps here, to see the ways in which we can understand another tradition by sort of getting inside their heads and attempting to see the world as Roman Catholics, at least in some ways, have seen it, and also attempt to understand some of the experience of Catholics in this country particularly, and some of the ways in which their experience in this country has been a very particular kind of experience. Well, I'm going to sort of start off by talking about theology a bit, then move to a quick bit of history about Catholicism in America, and then in a sense end up talking about how that history relates to that theology or those theological understandings. And I would want to say here that the theology I'm talking about that is not really at the level of formal doctrines per se or precise catechetical teachings, but rather of general understandings, feelings, almost half conscious sense about your faith and your religion that's developed by growing up in a particular kind of tradition and relating to that kind of tradition over time. And the things I'm going to stress, and I hope this isn't seen as divisive in any way, but are those elements that I think Catholics tend to have by virtue of their religious tradition that at least are not fully shared by many Protestants or Lutherans, or which would come out in somewhat different ways in, say, the Lutheran kind of tradition. And I picked up four sorts of elements of this kind of theological emphasis, I guess I would call it, that I would talk about in this regard. The first one, I'm simply saying the importance and primacy of the church as an institution, as the body that both creates and forms and shapes the faith of a religious believer. In Catholic tradition, one of the catechisms that young children learn, at least I used to, I don't know, maybe this has gone out now, they used to say, I believe everything that the Catholic Church believes and teaches. And of course they learn to say that long before they can possibly imagine all the vast things the Catholic Church believes and teaches. But that kind of catechetical instruction is meant to indicate that when you become a Catholic, when you participate in the faith, you are, in a sense, entering into a body of believers, a body of the church that is already pre-existing. And so the process of a faith, in a sense, works from the community that has a kind of autonomous and public and independent existence. And what you do when you acquire faith is to enter into that community, which has its own reality and an existence apart from yourself. Now, I don't know, and I wouldn't want to say this as a universal fact, but it seems to me that on the whole, most Protestants and even most Lutherans, even though the doctrines are much more complex than that, psychologically and religiously tend to sort of operate the other way. We tend to think of faith as something that we acquire personally, and then we sort of put together our little faiths and add up to the church. We don't, in a sense, think of the church first and then the individual. The second emphasis here that I'm talking about is that of universality and unity. There's a very strong emphasis in the Catholic tradition on the universality of the church everywhere, the church throughout the world, the ecumenical church. I think it's generally true that when a Roman Catholic says the phrase the church in any given moment, what is in the back of his or her head, whether completely articulated or not, is that vast body of nearly a billion people around the world, that vast communion, that whole communion of the church as it exists all over the place in the universal church. Whereas, again, I suspect that most Protestants and most Lutherans, when we casually say the church, we may mean our parish, or we may mean perhaps our denomination, but that is not quite as much in the same in our minds, the idea of the church universal as the primary form of the church than with its various other expressions. And similarly, the emphasis upon unity, a very strong sense that the church is one everywhere. That is the same church. And whether it is in the Philippines or in Africa or in Brazil or in Rome or in the United States or wherever, that is the same church. I think that sense is very strong in Roman Catholic teaching and in Roman Catholic understanding of the church. The third element I'd mention here is apostolic tradition. The idea that the church extends not simply through space, but through time. Again, this is a very common notion. We all sort of understand this, that the church passes through time. But in Roman Catholic teaching, this idea of apostolic tradition has a very specific and very powerful kind of meaning. The church is that body that is passed down directly from the apostles through the College of Bishops. And the College of Bishops is understood to be in direct succession of the apostles. Of course, the church is originally created by Christ. Through Christ, the authority is passed to the apostles. And then the church, through the College of Bishops specifically, is the body that passes on the tradition of the church. So that there is, well understood or poorly understood, for Roman Catholics, a very powerful and in fact legal and theological understanding that the church extends through direct succession of the apostles, through the laying on of hands of the bishops, the doctrine of apostolic succession. So that when a Roman Catholic in the Creed, for example, confesses, I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, that connotation of that apostolic understanding is there, whether or not it's perfectly understood or not. Whereas I think when we confess that creed, we have a somewhat different understanding in mind. And the last one I mention is hierarchical authority. This is the belief that the church carries authority. The church carries weight. The church as the tradition of the apostles, the church as the public church, and the church united throughout the world has the authority to teach the truth of the faith passed on by Christ through the apostles through all time and so on. And since this authority resides specifically in the College of Bishops with the Pope as its primate and head and a final authority, therefore, it has a kind of hierarchical character. That is, there is a different category of authority that resides in those leaders of the church. And the church, of course, is unified. All believers share a common faith. But there is a sense in which the church is a body based upon certain kinds of differences in spiritual authority. Okay. Well, those are hard. This is not a complete survey of Roman Catholic doctrine. I don't even pretend that. And on those points, of course, Roman Catholics would very much agree, and we would emphasize those things in which Roman Catholics would agree with other Christians. But I've pointed out here some ways in which it seems to me Catholicism has a different kind of sense or feel about it. If you are Roman Catholic, I think these kinds of emphases would sort of be at your fingertips in a way that they might not be for Lutherans. Okay, well, with that sort of background, then, I'm just going to briefly go through some of the experience of Catholics in the United States. And my point here is that the Church Universal, the Roman Catholic Church, and I would probably say all churches, while they may have certain eternal elements, certain elements that exist apart from society and history, and profess to teach the same faith at all times and in all places, on the other hand, they are also enculturated in history and society. And they live in particular kinds of traditions and particular kinds of places. And what happens, I think, historically then, is that any church, any religious community, has to go through a very complex process of both being enculturated in a particular location and place and time and situation, but also sorting out what is essential and what is secondary, so that it does not mistake what it is experiencing in its particular time and place for that which is of the essence of the core of the universal church. So in relation to America, then, what we have is this very particular historical experience of Roman Catholics in the United States, which is very, very different from the historical and cultural experience of Roman Catholics in Europe, as it existed for centuries and centuries, or in the Middle East, or in Russia, or in Africa, or in Latin America. It's a very particular kind of experience that leads to certain different kinds of cultural relations and self-understandings, but, and this is my final thesis that I'm leading up to, the tradition of the United States, the culture of the United States, is one that presents some very severe difficulties for Roman Catholic self-understanding in relation to theological tradition, how to relate those theological elements that I've mentioned to the kind of culture we have in this society is by no means an easy matter, and creates all kinds of troubles and difficulties, as well as all kinds of creative opportunities. Well, just to move through fairly rapidly in sort of historical succession without getting too bogged down here in details, I think the Catholic Church in the United States has essentially lived through five discrete eras, although to some extent these overlap and some of them carry on in other ways. The first one, very important to recognize, is that of the Hispanic Church. We don't often think of this in terms of American history and culture. We tend to start off, almost all our textbooks, if we're talking about American history, we'll start off with the Pilgrims or the Puritans or perhaps Jamestown. But if you sort of put on Catholic spectacles for a moment, or perhaps a broader transcultural perspective, you'll immediately recognize that part of the territory that's the United States was settled by Hispanics first, right? Columbus discovered, but then we had right away Coronado coming through the territory of the Southwest, people in Florida, the missions in Texas and New Mexico and California, all of which, well, actually those in the Southwest and Florida, were before any English-speaking people came to this continent at all. So you have here a kind of Hispanic and then also French coming from Canada, Catholic tradition on the territory that's now the United States before there were any, a single WASP here. Prior to that period. And from a Catholic point of view, historically, this has taken on great significance from a couple of standpoints. One, Catholics later on, even though the actual historical development of these things didn't add up to very much. I mean, most of them sort of petered out, except in parts of New Mexico and a little bit in California. Most of these sort of did not add up to a great deal until later on. But it's very important they say, we were here first. Catholics were here first. So later on, when all the accusations of un-Americanism came in, it was very important for Catholics to be able to point back and say, aha, the Catholic Church was sort of in America before all you Protestants and Englishmen and all this kind of thing. We were, and so, for example, in response to a lot of the anti-Catholicism in the 1890s, you got the organization of the Knights of Columbus, right? What are they emphasizing? America was Catholic. Columbus was Catholic first. And so they, in fact, advocated Columbus Day as a national holiday to emphasize that idea of a Catholic America first, and then the Protestants dribble in later on. And secondly, I would just mention at this point, this period of Hispanic Catholicism in America is very significant in terms of the history of Hispanic immigrations to the United States beginning in the 20th century again. And for the whole growth of the Hispanic church here, it's very important to be able to say that this isn't something popping up recently. No, it's a recovery of a long tradition that goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. But historically, that era, although it existed, was succeeded by what I might call the Republican era, lasting from about the 1640s up to the 1820s. These were the first settlements in Maryland by English Catholics. Lord Baltimore, English Catholics were a very tiny persecuted minority. They established the colony of Maryland as a haven for persecuted Catholics, and that was the first really English-speaking Catholic community in the United States. Very small, Catholics were still outlawed, really, in most of the other colonies, but Maryland was established as a Catholic haven, and it was there that the first forms of Catholic life in the United States developed. The importance of this era, I just mentioned a couple of things, were first of all that it did give Catholics in America their first experience with and understanding of and taste for the ideas of liberty and religious freedom and toleration. So that for Catholics, since they were such a tiny minority, naturally, to the extent that the English-speaking colonies moved in that direction, as they did over time, move toward less and less religious persecution and formalism, Catholics, in a sense, could affirm that from the standpoint of being a minority, definitely. They could come to understand that at some level. And at the time of the American Revolution, for example, most Catholics were very enthusiastic supporters of the developments of religious liberty and the promotion of toleration and so on. And Bishop John Carroll, who was the first Roman Catholic bishop in the United States, was a very strong supporter of the Revolution. And his cousin, Charles Carroll, was the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. These were sort of Maryland plantation hierarchs, both of them, really. But in their emphasis in terms of ideas, they could affirm that dimension of American culture which emphasizes religious liberty. The other thing about this period that's kind of interesting and really only been discovered in the last 15 or 20 years by historians is that it was a period of great lay strength in the church. That is, the laity played a very large role in governing the church. Church property was held by lay people. Lay people had a very large role in determining where the church would go and what it would do and so on and so on. So that it was a period in which there was a kind of accommodation to some of the ideas of republicanism and freedom of the individual that existed in that time. But, as I say, that was a period of a relatively small minority. And the real great era of American Catholicism, and the period that sort of fundamentally shaped the American Catholic community in the United States, was the immigrant era, roughly stretching from the 1820s to the 1920s. This was the period in which millions and millions and millions of immigrants, Catholic immigrants, primarily from Europe, came to this country. Most of them coming from peasant backgrounds, from sort of the bottom of society, most of them fleeing economic troubles, but also in some cases religious or other kinds of persecutions. You had, first of all, the Irish and the Germans in the 1830s and 1840s. The Irish coming off the potato famine, in many cases mass starvations on the boats, being dumped in Boston Harbor and the whole experience there, but later then followed up by Italians, Slavs, Lithuanians, Poles, Slovaks, and others, wave after wave of Catholic immigration to this country. Most of these people ended up in the big cities during the era of industrialization and urbanization. This experience made American Catholicism a great melting pot. If the United States as a whole is a melting pot, the Catholic Church here is even more of a melting pot. So many diverse ethnic groups. The Catholics and Germans sort of on the ground level in a sense, but then all these other ethnic groups as well. And I would also mention here the emphasis upon the work in which Catholics became involved in American urban politics and urban society. And the stereotype that sort of perhaps exists in your mind from this period is that of the Irish political machine. The Irish played a very important role in sort of mediating between the larger WASP culture and all the other Catholic immigrants. And in almost every big city, you had these Irish Catholic political machines, democratic machines mostly, that ran sort of things. And a typical situation is to have, you know, three brothers, and one runs the saloon, one is the precinct captain, and one is the priest. And that's sort of the your average Irish Catholic family. And you almost can't tell the saloon keeper from the priest, from the precinct captain, and they're all engaged in some way in the same work, creating this very tribal Catholicism, all devoted to advancing the interests of the people. And of course, throughout this period, you have the hostility to Catholicism in the United States, what's commonly called nativism. All the movements, beginning with the Know-Nothings in the 1840s, American Protective Association, Ku Klux Klan, all kinds of people saying Catholicism is un-American, it brings all these immigrants in, it teaches all these things that are foreign and dangerous, it's linked to the Pope is planning invasions, on and on and on. That's a whole separate and not terribly inspiring chapter of our history. The other thing I would mention about this, though, is that this is also a period in which the church institutionally recovers sort of its hierarchical forms in the United States. And of course, in terms of the church universal, this is a period in which hierarchy is being very much emphasized. The church at large is greatly on the defensive, sort of withdrawing to its fortresses. And in the United States, too, you can see almost a reciprocal process here in which the bishops become the primary defenders of their communities. To the extent they're attacked, Catholics respond by drawing themselves even closer, and that in turn inspires more attacks and so on. So this is the era in which the Catholic Church in the United States becomes a very hierarchical, very top-down kind of institution. Controlled very tightly, the image of a sort of smooth-running monolith, always somewhat exaggerated, but it nevertheless existed. Then you have this period that I would call the Americanizing era from the 1920s, 1950s. The great era of immigration ended in 1924 when Congress cut off the mass immigration. And so there you had a chance for the church, in a sense, to catch its breath and to really plunge into American life as it understood it at that time, to deeply want to become fully American. And if I wanted to use somewhat, I hope not too disparaging language here, I would call this the Notre Dame football era of American Catholicism, in which Catholics wanted to be sort of ultimate Americans, and that you got a lot of these movies and things that sort of tried to show that Catholics were, what was the one with the singer? Bing Crosby, sort of Catholics as sort of cute. They fit in with American popular culture. They're not dangerous. They're not threatening anymore, and we can kind of absorb them into our society. This is the message to the larger society. To Catholics, the message is we can make it here too. And you get a lot of emphasis, particularly on patriotism and on affirming the American way. During the era of Joseph McCarthy, for example, many Catholics felt that it was the Protestants now who were undermining American society and turning to communism and left-wing ideas. And one of the jokes of the time was that the period consisted of Fordham graduates in the FBI pursuing Harvard graduates in the State Department who were suspected of communism. You know, so you have sort of Catholics being the firm defenders of the American way. And along with this, of course, economically, a great period of making it a success, of increasing affluence, and so on. And all this, I think, probably culminating in the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960, which for Catholics in this country was a tremendously emotional experience to finally have one of their own after this long period in which they'd been sort of kept on the outside. In a sense, not perhaps to the same extent, but comparable, some of the sense of pride in one of our own that blacks experienced, say, with Jesse Jackson, was experienced by many Catholics in the election of Kennedy. Well, the final period, and the one I think we're still living through, is that of contemporary post-Vatican II era American Catholicism. And what I would simply observe here is that while Catholics thought that they'd had a full encounter with American culture in this period, what happened in relation to the 1960s in this country was that the church itself was undergoing a profound transformation in the year of Vatican II, at the same time that American culture was undergoing some very profound transformations, re-examinations, self-criticism, conflict, and so on. And what happened here was that Catholics, for Catholics, it was no longer sort of their culture over there and us over here, but they were part of that experience as well. And in that period of Vatican II and all the changes that came out of that, they began to discover that their relations with this culture and with the church were far more complex than they had imagined. In immediate response to Vatican II, many people thought, oh, great, the church is now catching up with some of the nice, good American ideas like religious liberty, for example, the Declaration on Religious Liberty in Vatican II, and we can move into a good, wholesome era of sort of peacefully moderated religious and social change, and everything will work out fine. But it didn't turn out to be that simple at all. After a relatively brief period of sort of moderate change, suddenly you had all these transformations, all these upheavals in the church, great amounts of dissent, priests getting involved in politics, nuns casting off their habits and engaging in all kinds of activities that had been previously inconceivable, all kinds of dissent and questioning and conflict in the church. And in that process, you sort of got great divisions and conflicts and disagreements within the Catholic Church as well, things that in these previous eras would have been almost inconceivable. Well, without going into the details of those changes and the different ways they are perceived by different elements of the Roman Catholic community, because for some people, the story is that Vatican II started the changes, it went a little way, but not far enough. And instead, we have a reactionary period, and what we need to do is recover that and go even further. Other people think Vatican II was okay, maybe a little bit too much change, but what happened is a bunch of crazy people took over and have pushed things far beyond what they ever should have been. And what we need now is to line up and whip some people back into line and shape things up and restore at least some version of the good old days. And you know, since we've been talking about stories, or we were talking about stories here last week, it's always an interesting sign when a community begins to have different stories about the same event. Good sign of division, right? Two versions of what went on back there. And you certainly have that, as well as many other kinds of conflict and diversity and change within American Catholicism. But to return to my four religious points, it seems to me that what you have here in very complicated ways is an encounter of this universal Catholic tradition with certain distinct elements of American culture. And this encounter, this relationship, this working out, this interaction is by no means a simple one at all. And just to go through these somewhat artificially perhaps, it seems to me the encounter with the idea of the primacy of the public church as the crucial religious institution, and therefore the crucial creator of values of faith and morals, runs up against those deep-seated American values of individualism, that we, the individual, is the autonomous source of truth, and a bedrock sense that I am what is the decider of what should be right. And Catholics, as I say, like the rest of us, have that element of American culture, in a sense, inside them. And how do you relate those two elements becomes a real difficulty, I think. How do you do it while remaining faithful to the tradition of the church, but at the same time being relevant and understanding your own culture? Secondly, universality and unity. How to understand your relations with that worldwide church, to understand the unity that you share with all those people, the profound religious unity that you share with people everywhere, the universality of that with those deep-seated American tendencies toward particularism, to believe that our experience is unique, or that we should somehow withdraw from that nasty world out there. Again, it seems to me that there are very good historical and cultural reasons why we think that way, but that's a very interesting sort of difficulty. Catholics have that difficulty, I think, in spades, more than American Protestants tend to, because they have that constant religious message, you are not alone, in a sense. You can't withdraw, at least religiously, and that then tends to carry social implications. Tradition, of course, here you might say the idea of tradition in the church comes up against the tendency in our culture to emphasize the present. Change. Everything new. Start over from scratch. Forget the past. How do you relate those two things? This is very complex, of course, because the idea of Catholic tradition itself has undergone some modifications here. How do you see, when you see change in the church, which changes in the church are necessary religiously, which ones do we affirm, how do we hold to the universal and unchanging elements while remaining relevant to our own day and age? Again, a very tricky kind of problem. And finally, the last one, and perhaps the most visible one, is that between the idea of hierarchical authority and, again, the very strong American cultural emphasis upon liberty and equality and democracy, that, in a sense, power flows from the bottom up, that everyone is equal, and that we are all free to choose. These are fundamental American political and social and cultural values. And yet here you have a church that says it don't work that way in the faith. Faith comes from the top down. Faith is something that is passed on through Christ to the apostles and the apostolic tradition. Well, what's involved there, I think, is a matter of trying to sort through and understand what is spiritual authority and how religious authority can be affirmed while not going along with elements that seem to be more the products of the long residence of the church in a social and political and cultural environment that also lined up spiritual authority with political authority, political hierarchy, economic inequality, social hierarchy, and so on. We don't affirm, at least as ideals, I'm not talking about the realities necessarily, but we don't affirm those as ideal values, as they might have been affirmed, say, in 17th century Europe. But at the same time, at least for a Roman Catholic, it becomes very difficult to say that you want to throw out the entire idea of authority without throwing out something essential in the church as well. So how do we affirm spiritual authority? How does the church affirm spiritual authority without also while being cognizant of these elements of social and political and economic democracy and equality and liberty? So that's my brief introduction to a very large subject, obviously, and I hope everybody can join in and offer your own comments and perspectives on this. I hope. Yes, sir. John.
Your background is what now?
I'm as Lutheran as most of you here, but I've ended up spending some time studying the Roman Catholic Church, sort of.
Then you're looking out. You're from the outside and you're looking in.
That's right. I come from
the inside and I'm looking out.
Okay. Well, you can tell me whether I got things real wrong or terribly wrong.
No, I in your brief summation, I didn't run into anything that upset me too much. I have to tell you our most recent Catholic joke that the Pope was walking with God in the garden, and the Pope asked God, he said, would there ever be women deacons? And God said, not as long as you're alive. The Pope said, will there ever be women priests? God said, not as long as you're alive. And the Pope said, will there ever be another Polish Pope? God said, not as long as I'm alive. So that's what we tell on ourselves.
Yes.
Well, I'm not Catholic, but I've worshipped in the Catholic tradition for the last 4 years in a church that is very inclusive, somewhat unique, perhaps, but I don't think that unique, particularly in this post-Vatican II era. There are many liberal Catholic churches. And my understanding is just that particularly with the advent of canon law since after Vatican II, that matters of conscience are placed very highly. I mean, people are to take their own conscience very seriously, and that in terms of church doctrine, that the final arbitrator is not the Pope in Rome, it's your own conscience. Bill's Catholic and I'm not. We were married in the Lutheran Church. I'm Episcopalian, at least. I'm a Christian. I happen to be brought up in the Episcopal tradition. I like liturgical churches. I mean, I just think that that's the only way to go, but I forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Well, I found it in the change of Vatican II. I made the statement, and she's heard this claim many times, but I made this to her in a group of people, and it rang very true, probably with a lot of people. I became a Catholic 30 years ago, and I worshipped an institution for 30 years, and finally found out I should be worshipping God. And it made me very, very angry at the Catholic Church and at the hierarchy who had control, and I felt that as long as I did the right thing, as kept the holy days, did my penance and whatever, that I was home free. You leave the priest take care of the rest of it. I finally found out that I was responsible for my own salvation. And I see that now that you're trying to go back to pre-Vatican II, and I'm very distressed at that too, because I think we were on the right track after Vatican II. That we more or less took responsibility for our own salvation without leaving somebody else do it for us.
I think that before Vatican II, many Catholics felt that the Pope, the bishops, the priests, and the nuns were running the church.
And they
Since
were.
Since Vatican II, and they were. Since Vatican II, we've got our handle on a lot of things, and now we're all in the pot together. And that's how we see the church now, as we are the people of God. And again, many things are left to our own conscience. So all of us are more involved in our church now. We're into more Bible study than we've ever been into before. We're into all sorts of things. And I kind of disagree with Bill, because I don't think we'll ever go back. Just never. The people wouldn't stand for it.
Not as long as I'm.
But we have a long, long way to go.
But you, perhaps you can see that there are certain tensions between some of these kinds of assertions. In my statements, I was reflecting what I think would still be, if you ask a good Catholic dogmatist or priest, or or theologian, what is the official position of the church on some of these matters of how faith is formed and how authority resides? That's what they would say, because that is, despite Vatican II, and in fact in Vatican II statements,
there was some.
Those things are still stated. Yeah, you would find dissenters as well, and of course the heat is rising. And there are some people who say, you know, the Americans are in trouble. They're headed off on a different direction, and, you know, they might, in the worst case scenario, you know, you envision some kind of schism. Very unlikely. But you obviously, there are people, for example, to whom the kinds of statements that we are now, our conscience now decides, rather than the community of faith deciding the right, is itself a very mistaken kind of notion.
All of this needs to be taken in the context of the fact that this country itself has gone through a social revolution in the last few years that's affected all churches and all of our
institutions,
culture.
Right.
And sure. We've talked about the Industrial Revolution, you talk about the Political Revolution, and we have in the last 30 years gone through the Social Revolution where values in all churches have been overturned.
Right. Yes, sir.
I went to a workshop in Portland a couple of years ago, put on by Hans Kuhn. And, I mean, it was sponsoring Hans Kuhn, but it was put on by the Episcopalian and Methodist Church. And the primary people attending it were Protestant denominations, even though he's a Catholic theologian.
Ah, more proof.
Yeah. Previous to his removal from the Catholic seat in Tübingen University in Germany. I think he sees the church not as the Catholic Church any longer, but as the merger of all Christian churches in one direction. He doesn't see the real difference other than the fact that we happen to have different names right now. And I think the kind of thing that's going on with Curran in Washington Catholic University, whereby he's suing the Catholic Church for being removed from his position as a theologian, is these kind of things are going to crop up more and more frequently, because the hierarchical dimension of the Catholic Church cannot continue, at least in America.
Dick.
Outside observation, it turns into a question. When I look at the kind of things that we're interested in, it seems to me that the Catholic people are all in the right, churches are all in the right places. As in cities, for example, they're still in the neighborhoods and still have a big stake in them. And not just the Polish neighborhood, but the Italian and the Irish and the Puerto Rican and the Mexican. In all the right places. And black, without the parochial schools, would be another story, for example, in the city at this time, Fort Huelva. Central and Latin America, Roman Catholic Church is there on both sides of the dispute. That's kind of maybe a church should be. And not monolithic. From the outside, it looks as though they're able to form little orders and shoot in and do things, and you don't have to wait for anything. Sometimes it seems, from where we're sitting, it's a little harder to get things going than that, at least sometimes appears to be. And you could even go on to talk about the teaching authority, if you like. I mean, when you got a lot of social movement going, you do get worried about things. Someone here was mentioning, like Jim Jones. You do like some kind of polity by which the ministry can be disciplined. So, is there not some sense in which this is a sort of Catholic moment?
Well, just institutionally, I think you're certainly right. That the Catholic Church is having a public impact, and I'm going to talk about that perhaps a little bit more tomorrow in terms of some of the bishop's statements and other kinds of Catholic social thought. I think they have arrived at a situation where they're having a public impact in this country, but also elsewhere. We're all conscious, without hardly even noticing it, of the ways in which Roman Catholic presence and social thought is affecting all kinds of folks in all kinds of ways. So I think you're entirely right. How that all sorts out in the relation between political social movements and religious authority and all those kinds of questions is very complicated. And one thing actually I have learned as an outsider, I've come to understand certain kinds of things, but It's easy to make quick judgments about the Catholic Church, but it's an immensely complex and subtle institution. And things that an outsider thinks are often just wrong. When I see divisions of a sort that I think, well, this is definitely going to lead to a split. I mean, you know, Protestants would have formed 8 different churches long ago. I mean, people would have marched off, set up their own little church and started their own body. They just break. They say, well, what's the use of fighting? In Catholicism, this all, because I think of that business of universality and unity, this takes on is the character of a deeper fight in the family. I mean, just, you know, fighting with your brother or sister, it gets nastier and nastier and nastier, but it's still, you're not going to say, they're not my brother or sister. You're still in there, and it gets bitter. And so that in fact, probably because of that, you, in a sense, you can't leave, or it becomes very hard to leave. And everyone is aware of the stakes in Catholic self-understanding. The stakes of leaving the church are enormous. And at least for me, I've learned to understand that even people who are, I think, very liberal or radical Catholics or very dissenting or very hostile or angry with the church, you press about 4 levels deeper, and there is an astounding loyalty and a deep sense that they don't want to get out of this. They'll fight for their vision of it, of course, immensely. But it's a very complex sort of relationship that develops there. And I think, and if I might be permitted to offer one more observation, I think Lutherans have a very particular kind of relationship to this whole tradition too, of course. And if you think about it very long, we're all aware that the Martin Luther was in fact the ur-dissenting Catholic who did not want to start a new church but wanted to reform the church. And did not leave, but was thrown out. And in his own self-understanding, remained a faithful Catholic. And what he did was to attempt to establish the Catholic tradition in his own form and way and carry it on outside the bounds of the institutional church. So to me, it's been studying Catholicism has been, in a way, a kind of self-revelation as well, recovering those elements of our own tradition that we see ways in which they are related at the root as well, although obviously they've developed in very complex ways over 500 years. I don't know if I answered your question.
I'd like to press that one a little further. How do Lutherans see themselves with respect to Western Catholicism?
Good, that's a good question. Could take a poll here. How do Lutherans see ourselves in relation to Catholicism, the Catholic Church, today, personally and collectively, maybe?
I might be able to touch on that. I was part of a Lutheran-Catholic dialogue that was supposed to have lasted for 6 weeks. At the end of 6 weeks, we found no differences, hardly. I mean, very minute. So it lasted for 6 months because we got to be party-goers together.
We got together to
theology turned into sociology.
But we felt like we were all a Christian body, and we really enjoyed one another, and we went to each other's churches to celebrate Mass. So it really became a very close community.
Walter.
Seems to be kind of interesting for me, that kind of experience, and also the results of the official, both national in the United States and international dialogues between Catholics and Lutherans, that those issues which were the dividing ones in the past are not felt as dividing anymore, and the kind of a certain difference seems to be still in the way we perceive the church itself. It's kind of interesting that the 4 points you put there, they're kind of in the realm of ecclesiology, so it's not justification by faith or other major issues, but this one. And I think you are right. I have always perceived also in Brazil Catholics as, well, dissenting in many issues and very critical of the Pope and so on. But there's a certain sense, even then in relation to the Pope, a sense of unity. He is
he's Roman, everything he's saying, but he's the Pope.
And in fact, the year I spent here, the Pope came to the United States, and I read some polls and surveys of among Catholics, and if they were accurate, they were saying, well, the vast majority of the Catholics sympathize with the Pope, an excellent person, and so on. When the question was around issues, celibacy of the priest, ordination of women, or
birth control,
birth control, and so on, the vast majority were against what the Pope was teaching. But nevertheless, they liked the Pope. And I think even deeper than when we come to the Eucharist, you mentioned the liturgy, and so the Eucharist as a unifying point for Catholics. While we have so much it in our doctrines, we think that the Catholic Church is very doctrinal, but we do have the true doctrine, and so we place it kind of in words. And when we struggle about words, we then kind of divide among our denominations, and especially when the influences of sort of liberalism and individualism going alongside with that.
I think you're right, and I have read all these documents, the dialogues, but you're exactly right, because the series that they had where they found the greatest disagreement was over the doctrine of the Church, the authority of the bishops, this whole business of apostolic hierarchical authority. They were still very far apart on that. Because what you get into then is this whole business of public dissent by a representative of the Church. That's really where the Catholic Church can tolerate immense amount of dissent among its lay folks. People can complain about this and that, dissent from doctrine, as long as the Church is teaching. But what you get into is why Curran is in trouble. He is teaching as an official theologian of the Roman Catholic Church. And then the Church says, you are now representing us officially, therefore you may not get out of line. That's the key question there. And on that, Lutherans and Catholics are still very far apart. The current series that's going on is on Mary and the Saints, and I think that'll be very interesting to see how that comes out, because that's always been a traditional sort of polemical point. But even on that, there's a lot of dialogue and recovery and understanding of Mary, understanding of the saints. I learned from someone last year, which I didn't know, is that the official Lutheran teaching from the 16th century, which I had no idea was true, is that the saints do in fact pray for us in heaven, but we can't invoke them or ask them to pray for us. How many Lutherans here knew that? I certainly didn't. That's what's taught in the official documents. That's the point of disagreement. The saints are in heaven praying for us, but we can't ask them to. And don't ask me to explain why.
I'd be interested to know that the thing that really got the whole bit started, indulgences, is something we don't even talk about anymore. That's you couldn't get any priest to explain indulgences anymore.
Is purgatory, is that sort of by the side to that, or is that
purgatory? All right. We just call it a rest stop.
You sure you're not going to spend some time there, John?
I wouldn't mind that. It's that other place I'm worried about.
But that isn't talked about in the church anymore, in the Catholic Church? Or?
Indulgences aren't. I haven't heard too much about, well, nobody hears much about hell anymore. That's not a popular item at all.
Depends on the church you go to.
Don't you think that purgatory is at least implied in the fact that you pray for the dead?
Yeah.
I mean, anytime you have a funeral and you pray for the dead, not just to God to comfort the family, you are in effect saying, if this person is not in heaven, then we pray, we offer these prayers so that you bring him to heaven.
Our doctrine of the communion of the saints then certainly recognizes purgatory. We believe in the church triumphant.
Well, I'm Catholic too.
Yes, the church triumphant. The church suffering and the church struggling. So the church suffering is purgatory.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I mean, if you pray for a dead person, there's no need to pray for them if they're already in heaven or if they're already in hell. So praying for them implies that they may not be there in purgatory.
I think it's true, still true in Catholic liturgies, that prayers are offered on behalf, I don't know exactly what you pray for, that they might achieve glory or something like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The communion of the saints is still official doctrine.
Yeah, well, sure.
Mm-hmm. I have a question that I kind of struggle with in terms of democracy in the Protestant churches as opposed to hierarchy. And I'm not sure which is better. I'm just interested in getting feedback. In a Catholic church, a priest or a clergy is assigned to a parish. So that the people really don't have the choice, although if they're dissatisfied, they can complain. But basically, they're given their priest, they're assigned their priest. Whereas Lutherans will call. Mm-hmm. I see an advantage to both kinds. I see an advantage in the Catholic tradition, and I'm not sure which has the greatest advantage. If a person is going to be prophetic, his job is not in the line if the people do not like what they're hearing. Whereas on the other side, if a Lutheran pastor wants to be sensitive to the needs of the people, he feels that responsibility because he knows that they are the ones who support him, they are the ones who call him. And so in that sense, it's good. But in the other sense, if you dare to be prophetic, and if you offend the people to whom you are prophetic, then they can dismiss you.
Comments on that? I would say that would be a point of sort of institutional organization of the church, not doctrine per se. Mm-hmm. But that you're right. I mean, in a sense, it goes along with this sense people have of a great hierarchy up there, lining up and doing things from top down and so on. But you're quite right.
I think that all of them are involved in the same kind of pressures because there's process. In eliminating a pastor that the church council has to go through, bishop and all through that sort of stuff. But you get the practical minded, and it's just like someone said, like as far as the Pope going into Ireland and really straightening that out. He refuses to do that because he would lose so many Catholics in England, and the trade-off is so poor number-wise that it's not a wise political move to make.
There are examples that are very dramatic in Catholic history, for example, where you might affirm the values that are going on there in the integration in New Orleans and St. Louis, I think, in the 1940s, this was long pre-Vatican II, but the cardinal would simply decide all Catholic schools must be integrated. And, here you had very racially segregated and even racist folks, but boy, the cardinal said it, and bang, the next day it was over. And people, that was it. Whereas I can imagine in Protestant churches, first of all, nobody could give the order, and second, if they did, that pastor or whatever bishop would be out on his ear. And that was the bad old days, I suppose, of hierarchy. But there was a case where hierarchy worked for values that you would probably want to affirm. So it's, yeah.
In Oregon, they do, the Catholics do interview the priests that are coming to their parishes. And they do have a say on who's coming to their parish. That's just an Oregon, huh?
The final vote is the collection basket. If you don't like it, you just don't put any more money in it. Get rid of it.
I wonder what you might think of the situation in Latin America, where in the Catholic Church the hierarchy is taking the side of the poor. And time after time you find people's...
Well, the hierarchy is divided. I mean, on political questions, the hierarchy is all over the block. You have people who are extremely conservative. You have Obando Bravo in Nicaragua. Walter told us in Brazil, you now have the Pope appointing more conservative bishops. So the hierarchy is all over the place.
But there are a goodly number of them that are standing with
sure,
the poor
sure.
as opposed to the governmental
sure.
authorities
oh, sure,
and the rich and
sure.
powerful.
Yeah. Sure, sure. And again, the teachings on these matters that Walter was discussing last week and still discussing is very complicated. I mean, even the papal documents on liberation theology, the first one was a sort of shape up here, 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 and here, but then the second one sort of backed off and said, well, if you don't do this, 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 and this, you're probably okay, and this is good to do. And so it's sort of one hand and the other, and presumably people that are implementing those things read those. If you're a cardinal, you have to read them. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.